Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who has offered transapical mitral valve repair procedures for more than 3 years and currently serves as a trial site for over 50 clinical trials. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Less than 2 weeks ago, Iranian citizens in the northern city of Mashhad responded to increasing economic hardships and government corruption by taking to the streets in protest. The movement quickly expanded to protest in more than 1,200 Iranian cities. The size of the crowds quickly grew from dozens to thousands. More than 20 protesters have been killed and about 1,000 arrested. The Iranian protests were sparked by dramatic increases in the price of basic staples, including eggs, poultry, and milk. About 12% of Iranians are unemployed. Youth unemployment hovers around 29%. Efforts at social reform in the previous two decades have often been described as unsuccessful. To talk about what's driving the protest and what it means in the long run is Dr. Mehdi Norbask, professor of international affairs at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Dr. Norbask, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. All right. Protests in Iran against the government are unusual. There have been others, and we'll talk about this throughout the program, but there have been others. But this is extraordinary. How extraordinary is it?
It was spontaneous. It was not planned. That is a segment of the population that was not recognized by the political activists inside Iran. And when that demonstration for the first time appeared in Mashhad, in Mashhad, those people who were opposing Rouhani on the conservative side,
the president of Iran, yes,
they planned that that demonstration. They wanted to contain it and use it as a pressure type of, you know, demonstration against Rouhani. But very quickly, it went out of hand, out of their control, and it spread to all of the other cities of Iran. And the slogans that they used in Mashhad, they were mostly against Rouhani. But as soon as people participated in various cities of Iran, even in Mashhad, then very quickly, it became against the leadership. I'm talking about Ali Khamenei. And very much grievances that existed in Iran because of the corruption, because of the mismanagement of the economy, because of lack of freedom. Many argue, and I have seen it a lot in the West, they are writing about those, you know, demonstration. It was not only economic. It had a huge political dimension, and we have to take into consideration that those people who came out in various streets of Iran, they were really asking for freedom, opening up the country to outside world. Many of them, these are younger generation, they want to have contact and connection with Western countries. You know, in the past, Iranians were very much trained, a lot of them, in the United States. And they want to have those access. They want to have freedom. They want to have freedom of assembly. All of those, a combination, very much.
I think it's important to clarify, to point out that, as you said, that the original demonstrations were by conservatives against President Rouhani, who we consider has often been described here in the United States as moderate compared to administrations in Iran. So these were conservatives, but as you said, it quickly turned that the citizens of Iran said, you know, we don't like what's going on.
For your audience, they they must understand that in Iran, there are two sides to the Iranian government. Both of them supposed to be elective and elected. Even Khamenei, which is on the authoritarian side of the Iranian politics.
The Ayatollah.
Is usually elected by the assembly of experts. Every 6 years, 80 people are elected freely by the Iranian people, and they elect, you know, a leader, a spiritual leader, according to the Iranian constitution. But that assembly of experts, is very much tilted toward authoritarianism because most of them are cleric. On the other side, there is free election in Iran for the president, for the parliament in Iran. Both of them are, you know, free. Of course, the candidates are screened by, you know, by cleric. I'm talking about the authoritarian side. But Iranians are battling. They are struggling between the two. And very much in the last couple of decades, you have seen from the time that Khatami came to power, and definitely we had a fraudulent election in 2005-2009, Iranians are battling for democracy. And definitely Rouhani is a candidate on the reformist side. He is not totally a reformist, but he is a moderate conservative that a lot of us, me, supported him because the choice on the other side was an ultra-conservative against the United States, against everything. Then in Iran, we should, you know, we have to understand that the only country in the Middle East that I'm very optimistic about the future of democracy in is Iran. Iran is a battle between two forces of authoritarianism and democracy. And the cleric are not divided on either, you know, side. You see, on the reformist side, a lot of cleric. Khatami was a very moderate, pro-democracy cleric who was the president of Iran. And then Ahmadinejad came from 2009. But there is a battle. And this is part of, you know, that battle.
When you say that Rouhani is a moderate, what does a moderate mean? I mean, I can't imagine that someone can even run for president in Iran that we're going to support the United States or we're not going to be the enemy of the United States after we've had such a relationship for the past 38 years. So what is a moderate in Iran?
Moderates in Iran for democracy, moderates in Iran are for opening up the country to outside world. Moderate in Iran are for investment from Western countries. Moderate in Iran are for sending students out, sending students in. Very much they want to open the country to outside world. On the other side, conservatives always see in that kind of relationship or that kind of approach a conspiracy. They don't like the West for apparent reason, because a lot of Iranians are very educated in the West, are educating themselves, in the West. And West has been always a type of refuge for intellectualism in Iran, in the sense that a lot of those countries, the Western countries, are a source of inspiration for democracy, for various kind of really living a free, free life. And Iranian, that in their history, they were never tilted toward the Soviet Union. Always Western countries, United States, has been, a focal point for a lot of Iranian. They came over here. You know that Iranian community in this country, we have close to about 1 million Iranian in this country. And all of them, that they are in commerce, they are in business, they are in health, they are in science. They are working in NASA, they are working in various places. And United States and West has a very special kind of place in the Iranian mind. Mm-hmm. They don't want to look at it, as an antagonistic, country. Trump and, the new things is totally a new thing. But Iranians were very much inspired by the previous administration.
And we're to talk about the nuclear deal and what the Trump administration may do in trying to renege on that deal. But let's talk about the situation as it stands right now in Iran and what is driving these protests. And there are several aspects we can look at: economic, social, and corruption of the government. Economically, what's the situation in Iran right now?
Economically, Iran is very much in the area of labor force, 2.5% growth every year. Currently, in Iran, 3 million jobs are needed. The age of 15 to 29, the unemployment is 24% in that range. Iran currently need around $150 to $200 billion for investment from outside. And this is the shape of the economy. And on the other side, of course, you see a lot of pressure. Yes, of course, Rouhani went through the nuclear agreement with the United States, but this administration is not very friendly with Iran. They do not look at the that force that I told you, that you have to take the side of the democracy and you have to understand Iranian politics. You cannot, you know, sit outside and always, you know, just push, you know, toward criticizing what, you know, you see on the other side. I'm talking about, you know, Rouhani. The best that the West, you know, can do at the moment, not interference, really lift some of those, you know, sanctions. You know that, you know, now after the nuclear deal, the financial situation, the banking system is not, you know, comfortable to deal with Iran yet. And that is a huge impediment for the government of Rouhani. Then the best way to go for the Western countries is really to work through it and understand that dynamic in Iran. This is our point. This is my point as a political activist outside the United States, that you have to recognize, you know, that dynamics in Iran. You should not, you know, look at the Iranian government or the Iranian regime as a monolithic type of, you know, regime. You have to understand this battle.
And there are those who have said that if the United States would pull out of the nuclear deal with Iran, that what it would do would it would strengthen the conservatives again.
Absolutely.
That the conservative parts that we talked about earlier of the government or of Iranian society would say, see, we told you so. Yeah. This is we can't count on the United States. Yeah. They pulled out of this.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And Iranian, in terms of the knowledge, in terms of the technological capabilities, they really can expeditiously go to nuclear bomb. There is no question about it. And if you want to see a future country like North Korea, you are more than, you know, welcome to deal with the Iranian regime, you know, that way. But you have to recognize that Rouhani and those moderates inside Iran, they really do not want to take Iran to that, you know, that end. And this is very important to understand it. They need help. They need help to battle the conservatives on the other side. And bashing the whole Iranian government does not solve any problem whatsoever.
I want to talk more about some of the social and some of the corruption issues in Iran in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle. Its 11 principal investigators and 12 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Mehdi Norbask, who is professor of international affairs at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. We're talking about the protest in Iran, situation in Iran. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Norbask, we were talking a little bit about, you know, the situation in Iran right now. We talked about economics a little bit. What about socially? You know, with the religious aspects of Iran right now, it seems to us in the West that there isn't a whole lot of freedom, that women especially don't have a whole lot of freedom, and that, you know, as you said, there are so many people who have been educated in the United States, have lived in the United States, and see the freedoms that we enjoy here and would like to have those same kind of freedoms. Socially, what is it like in Iran?
Very tough for the younger generation. They tried very much to impose all kind of restrictions on the younger generation. But this young generation is very resilient, very much battling on every front that, you know, you can imagine. Then more than what we think in Iran, there are freedom for, of course, for this younger generation, of course, not because the Iranian government wanted to give them the regime, to give them the freedom, but they are battling for it. For example, in terms of the covering in Iran, you see that, you know, you have women in Iran who are totally covered, and you have younger generation who are not really, do not give, I'm so sorry for my language, give a damn of what, you know, what they are saying. Then the Iranian population, close to about 70% of the Iranian population is under 35. Most of them have not seen the Iranian Revolution. Iranian Revolution took place 38 years ago. What they want is freedom. What they want is a life that is comfortable compared, of course, to everybody else, highly educated. Let me give you one, you know, one example. Under the regime of the Shah before the Iranian Revolution, close to about 8% of the 8% of the population, the universities, were women. Under this regime, I'm talking about from the beginning of the Iranian Revolution now, 52%, the population is 52 to 48 in the universities. 52% women, 48%, you know, men. Very vibrant. The society is young. The society is very innovative and highly educated. And Iranian society is not a society that you can compare it, for example, to Saudi Arabia, to some, you know, other, you know, Arab countries. I'm not talking about, you know, race. I'm not talking about, you know, those things. But Iranians are highly educated, always, as I told you. They had a bridge. They had a type of connection to the Western, you know, countries. And that is their orientation. They want to have, you know, freedom, and they are fighting for it in various ways that you can imagine. When you go to the universities in Iran today, Iranian students are highly, highly political. Iranian universities are not the same as universities in the West, that the students go to the class and, you know, go to the door. They are highly, you know, active through various political clubs in the universities. Iranian students are in the forefront of the battle for democracy. This is overall, you know, how you see the Iranian society today.
You know, it seems like there's some irony there that we talk about women and whether they're covered, and that 52% of university students are women. That would seem to, well, that statistic alone, if someone from the outside didn't know anything else about it, look at it and say, oh, well, this must be a liberal society. But it's not.
It is not. But as I said, they are very much, they have not accepted the control of the authoritarian side of the regime. Inside the universities, they are battling. In the last couple of days, a lot of students were arrested outside the wall of the universities. And now the ministers of the Rouhani government, they are very much for it and behind, you know, the students to free them. It is a battle. It's a battle, you know, inside Iran. There is no country in the Middle East that, believe me, you can compare the Iranian students and the younger generation in terms of their political activism too. Very different country. You know that Iran in the Middle East is the first country that went through the constitutional revolution at the beginning of the last century. And Iranian, they went through a lot. In 1953, you know, Mossadegh, of course, was a prime minister. Very much in the West, we are thinking mostly about the coup and the nationalization of the Iranian oil industry. But Mossadegh was a Democrat. Mossadegh was a liberal. When he came to this country to visit the United Nations, he went to Philadelphia, and the mayor of Philadelphia gave him the key of the city. He was that much, you know, thinking about the Western, you know, people under the Truman administration. Truman administration very much recognized the right of the Iranian government to nationalize the oil and very much respected Mossadegh. When Eisenhower came to power, that is totally a different story. What I want to tell you, I want to take you back to the history, that there have been, there had not been always that kind of antagonism that you see today. That is mostly not from the Iranian people. That is mostly from a conservative elite that is very ideological, and their interest is in very much antagonism toward West.
Corruption.
Corruption.
What kind of corruption do you see in Iran?
You see a lot of cronyism. You see, for example, in the current budget, that the Rouhani, for the first time in the Iranian history after revolution, exposed, you know, that budget. You see a lot of money is devoted to clerical establishment, various, you know, foundation compared to the ministries and others. And Rouhani is telling the Iranian audience, the Iranian, you know, citizens, that more than half of the budget that is under my control is not really under my control. This is one side of the economy and the corruption that you can see it in a sense. Corruption is everywhere in other, you know, other ways. When you go to Iran at the moment, the Revolutionary Guards is very much the mother of all corruptions in Iran. If you want to do business in Iran, very much you have to have a kind of connection with the Revolutionary Guard. More than 60% of the economy of Iran is under the control of the Revolutionary Guard. Revolutionary Guard is the same as Egyptian military. They have a lot of control on the economy. One of the things that really did not allow Egyptian to succeed after the Arab Spring was the role of military. If you, when you compare it, for example, to Tunisia, one of the huge factors in these two countries, what was the role of military? In Egypt, military had vested interests in the economy. They did not allow democracy to develop. In Tunisia, a poor country, military stood on the side of the people, and with all of the problems that Tunisians, you know, have, they are developing their democracy. Then, as I said, a huge part of the Iranian economy is under the control of the Revolutionary Guard and a lot of corruptions. Then you have the sons and daughters of the clerics, who are close to the, of course, authoritarian side of the government. They have privileges that the rest of the society does not, you know, have in terms of connection to outside, all of those things. Then the corruption in Iran is rampant. And Rouhani is very much trying to expose it through the budgets and in other areas. And that is another huge thing in the Iranian politics.
I have heard that one of the biggest reasons for the protest was that the size, the percentages of the budget devoted to military and religion was exposed. And
absolutely,
people looked at it and said, yeah, what about the rest of us?
Absolutely.
Let's take a phone call from Paul in Lancaster. Paul, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. The United States has a very contradictory relationship in the Middle East. For instance, Iran has been evolving towards democracy, and it is a democratic country. And we have somehow gotten upset, we're so angry towards Iran, and yet our best friend is Saudi Arabia, which is no democratic. which is no democracy. We have been friendly with Saudi Arabia since going back to the early 20th century. And in all those years, we have never, ever fostered democracy in Saudi Arabia. And yet we complain about Iran. That is ridiculous.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Is there some inconsistency there?
Yeah. Yeah, there is inconsistency, especially in this administration. I'm not saying that, you know, there is a full democracy inside, you know, Iran, but there is a battle for democracy in Iran.
And can I interrupt for just 1 second? Yeah. I mean, one thing that we haven't really mentioned is that Iran has been designated as a state sponsor of terrorism as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, of course, we do know in Saudi Arabia, 9/11, the majority of the terrorists came from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the kind of terrorists that Iran, you know, support in the Middle East, for example, we designated Hezbollah in Lebanon, for example, as a terrorist organization, Iran, you know, support Hezbollah. But Hezbollah is not an international organization as against, for example, Al-Qaeda, other, you know, other organization, or, you know, ISIS or, you know, Daesh. Yes, Iranians, you know, support those groups too, but we have to remember, you know, this, that 19 of the terrorists who came, you know, in September 11, they came from Saudi Arabia and other, you know, Arab countries. Iran is not into that kind of terrorism, and we have to recognize that there is, of course, no discussion about that. As I said, Iran is not a full democracy, but in the Western country, we have to recognize this fact that there is a battle for democracy in Iran. And more than ever, the Iranian governments, I'm sorry, the Iranian people really expect the Western countries to support that. Let me give you, Scott, you know, one example in the last, you know, couple of days. You know, when we have the Charlotte's incident in the United States, President Trump, after a couple of, you know, days, came back and tried to judge who is, of course, involved and both sides. And we remembered, you know, all of those. But from the first day of the Iranian uprising in Iran, Trump took the side of the demonstrators. And I'm not saying is bad to take the side of, you know, democracy, but we have to remember that in that country, when Trump or any administration take the side that, you know, directly and trying to bash the Iranian government, then you have the conservatives that reads into their hands. And that was a question in Iran, you know, among a lot of intellectuals and the Iranian, you know, students and others, that this is the administration who is banning the Iranian from coming to the United States, the same, you know, population. But at the same time, when it comes to the demonstrations, right away jumps into, you know, the wagon of demonstration. Then they don't see consistency in that, you know, regard, and especially from the time that Trump administration took power, the close relation with Saudi Arabia, as all of us know at the moment what is going on in Saudi Arabia, and taking the side of the Saudis against, you know, Iran, it is not conducive to any kind of, you know, peace building and democracy promotion and all of those in that, you know, part of the world. That is overall the debate and the discussion that is going on among the intellectuals inside Iran.
Obviously, this is a complex situation, and there probably is not one answer to this question. But overall, long term, what do these protests do? What do they mean?
The protests in Iran, this is the first time. You know that in the Iranian constitution, the right to demonstration is recognized in the Iranian constitution. But always the authoritarian side with the justification that foreigners are inside, you know, those demonstrations.
All of this. The West is always pushing it.
These demonstrations decide, and the various cities of Iran and small cities of Iran. Scott, in the past, we had major cities of Iran, like, you know, Tehran and Isfahan and others, you know, that they were the bastion of intellectualism, major universities, they were participating in demonstration. But now you go to tiny cities of Iran where conservatives had some upper hand, and you see demonstrations in those, you know, small cities. It's a new phenomenon. It's a new development within the Iranian politics. It is a welcome new development within the Iranian society. The first thing that it has done in the last couple of, you know, days is the recognition of the rights of the Iranian people according to the constitution for demonstration. The first city council in Iran that voted yesterday to devote places in a city of Tehran. There was a city council in Tehran that they voted yesterday, the absolute majority, that they want to devote a place in Tehran for demonstrations and just, you know, for people, you know, to come and, you know, participate in demonstration. Then that is a right to demonstration. That is the outcome, the first outcome that you can see. The second thing that you can see is that there are a lot of problems in Iran, and those demonstrations in various cities of Iran shocked a lot of activists, shocked a lot of other people, that if they do not create contact with that segment of the population in the future, it may, you know, go out of control, out of, you know, hand. Then the reconfiguration of the political activism in Iran is at the moment is debated. How we can connect to that, you know, segment of the population that is not necessarily university goers, not necessarily, not that, you know, they are not. But that is a segment of the population that for the first time came out. Mostly they are, you know, poor, very, very young, and we have to do something about it.
Now, this regime has shown that it will meet opposition sometimes violently. Yeah. I mean, when we have more than 20 people killed, 1,000 people arrested. Is it an exaggeration to think that this is the beginning of a new revolution? Or is it just too soon to tell that, or is that not the mood in Iran right now?
Iranians, they don't want to go through another revolution. A variety of reasons. I don't want to go, you know, waste your time at the moment. Iranians are sick and tired of revolution. Iranians want to go through a gradual, you know, change. And that has been the warning in the last couple of days to the Iranian government, that if you don't take care of that business, take care of the, you know, the economy, take care of the corruption, take care of the, you know, political participation, then this is a future that you see, the future of unrest. And if you cannot control it that way, you may not be able to control it later on. And that is a warning in the last, you know, couple of days to the Iranian government. And honestly, I wrote, you know, something in Persian. Let me tell you something else, you know, Scott, you know, to know that is, you know, fascinating. There is a platform in Iran, it's called Telegram. We are not using it in the United States yet. 40 million Iranians out of 80 million, half of the population is participating in that platform.
Social media.
They can mobilize instantly. In Iran, political parties are not strong because the authoritarian side does not allow it. But that kind of communication has been crucial. And the authoritarian side in the last couple of days came to curtail access to Telegram and the social media. And right away, you could see protests from the population. And now the ministers and the Rouhani, they are battling not to curtail it. They want to, you know, keep it, you know, that way. And this is the vibrancy that you see inside Iran that sometimes, you know, we don't see it, you know, from outside.
And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the program is that
even though you can't
go back to Iran, you still provide that insight.
Absolutely.
Dr. Mehdi Norbas, Professor of International Affairs at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology, thank you very much for
your insight. Thank you for having me, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Tom Corbett became the first incumbent governor to lose a re-election bid in Pennsylvania history when he lost to Democrat Tom Wolf in 2014. Former Governor Corbett has largely been quiet publicly in the last 3 years, but he spoke with WITF's Radio Pennsylvania News Director Brad Christman recently, and Brad is with me now. Brad, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
All right, so And by the way, if you have a question or comment about some of the things that Governor Corbett has to say, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. As I said, Governor Corbett has not spoken out in the last 3 years, over 3 years, since he lost that re-election in 2014. Why not, and why is he speaking now?
Well, I think he's enjoying private life. He's doing some teaching at a couple of universities he has over the last few years, and I think he's enjoyed that. I think the reason that this interview came about is, you know, when he was governor, we ran the Ask the Governor program on Radio PA, and he appeared on that program 39 times. It's a record for any governor in the number of appearances on that show. And as you well know, because you used to host that show, it goes back to Governor
right,
Casey.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we stayed in touch, you know, occasional texts every once in a while, just, hey, how are you? And we always said we wanted to do another show after he left office. And I think he just decided 3 years was enough time. He happened to be coming to Harrisburg for a congressional candidate fundraiser. And so he reached out and said, hey, let's do it now. I do know, though, he also did a piece on PCN over
right,
the holiday
right.
week. So that's two kind of back-to-back there.
So the big question, we have some audio from your conversation with former Governor Corbett in just a few minutes. But as I mentioned in the introduction, he was the first incumbent governor in Pennsylvania's history. Of course, this is a recent history where we've actually been able to elect a governor for more than one term. It goes back to the 1970s.
Right. The parties swapped every
right,
8 years.
Yeah. Even after that, once governors could run for more than one term. So we have something here. We have a clip, and it's a fairly lengthy one, but where you question him about a couple reasons why he thinks that he lost re-election. But I want to provide some context here. The first year that Governor Corbett was governor, during the last year of the Rendell administration, when the Obama administration, President Obama, came to office as part of stimulus money from the federal government, it was given to states across the country. Pennsylvania used a great deal of its money, over $1 billion, toward education.
Right. Despite warnings, don't use this in your line items.
That is what Governor Corbett has said, that Governor Corbett said, don't use this in your line items. But when that money, that federal money, wasn't there anymore, Governor Corbett said, you know, you're out of luck because you were told not to use this money. But it was called, and successfully by many people, it was called a cut.
Right.
Now, you can make the point that it was a cut, but at the same time, you know, that there is that background. So here's a clip of you talking with Governor Tom Corbett, former Governor Tom Corbett, about why he thinks he lost. Not only does he talk about the budget, especially the education budget, but there's another part in there that a lot of people can relate to.
Have you Monday morning, we talked about Monday morning quarterbacking a while ago, have you Monday morning quarterbacked the 2014 election and gone back and said, okay, here's where it went wrong?
Sure. And some of it is more recent that it's finally dawned on me. The easiest thing is, and this is my most recent determination, I went about delivering the first budget wrong.
How so?
Well, we didn't tell anybody what was coming, did we? And we delivered the budget sort of like an indictment. Keep quiet, deliver it, and it hit everybody, you know?
Yeah.
And it riled everybody up.
And you're talking mostly probably about the education
line items. Mostly the
education,
right, yeah. Okay. Riled everybody up, and I made permanent opponents. I don't call them enemies, permanent opponents. If I had it to do over again, I would have gone out and worked the budget publicly, say, this is what's coming. You need to know how bad it is. This is what we're finding. We've got all this federal money. It's not there anymore. And really sold or informed everybody, got them ready so it wasn't such a blow right between the eyes. That's number one. Number two, if you recall, right after we delivered that budget, the State Education Association started spending money on TV ads and really went to town on TV ads. I probably should have spent the same type of money, campaign money, not taxpayer money, to respond to it. So we put ourselves behind the eight ball. Those two, I think, would have changed the result of the 14 election.
The 800-pound gorilla in the room when you talk about your 2014 election, no, don't look around, it's proverbial, is Joe Paterno. Not Sandusky, but Joe Paterno and his firing as a factor in the 2014 election. 2010, you won Center County 54-45. 2014, 57-42, Wolf. A lot of people tagged you because you were with the Board of Trustees at the time Joe Paterno was fired.
I was the Attorney General that started the investigation.
But it wasn't – I don't think Sandusky had anything to do with that
can't separate the two because the one leads to the other.
Okay. I'll grant you that. But I think the firing of Joe Paterno was what fired a lot of voters up. Have you thought about that?
Oh, sure. I mean – I think I told you, one guy came up to me. I've had one person come up to me.
You said this off the air before we started recording.
I had one person come up to me after I lost the election in the fall. And came up to me in our grocery store at home. And he was making a beeline right towards me. I went, okay. And he said, you Governor Corbett? I said, yes. He says, we got you. And he pointed to his jacket. And he had a Penn State jacket on. And okay. Nice to meet you. And then went on my shopping. So certainly there was that impact. But two things. I go to the investigation. I couldn't duck that investigation.
Of course not.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was on the board. Because it was a grand jury matter, I couldn't tell them what was coming. That was difficult. But then we have the night of the vote, and I wasn't there.
You were by conference call, correct?
I was on the phone in the governor's library in the governor's residence, and clearly conference calls aren't as good as being there in public, and you can't read the room because you can't see the room, and they call for the vote, and they asked for my comments towards the end, and this is public; it's been out there before, and I did. I told them, I said, you have to remember the children when you're making this decision. And I wasn't talking about Paterno, but everybody thinks I was. I was talking about the administration. And they made a decision. Now, when that was done, I ended the conversation. I had no idea that they were just going to call Joe Paterno. Had I been there, was a Monday morning quarterback, I would say, no, we have to go there. And if you recall, there was concern about getting there for safety and everything.
Yeah, a crowd had grown around the Paterno home at that point. Yeah.
Well, if I would have gone there. Had I been there, I would have gone there. As the governor, I would have been able to get in. I would have been able to. And Mr. Paterno, you have to hear what's happened. The doing it over phone, I thought, was a mistake. A lot of mistakes occurred. I don't think there was any malice. At all.
But sitting here now 6 years later, do you still believe that Joe Paterno should have been fired?
I told you I didn't vote then, and I'm not voting now.
Well, what do you
believe? I think
you
the board.
You won't weigh in? You won't tell me if you think that was the right move or not?
I don't know that. I'm going to make you wait here a second.
That's okay. I've got all the time in the world.
It was hard to fathom, even for me, that Mr. Sandusky did what he did. I'm sure it was very difficult for Mr. Paterno to fathom that, too.
And you think that
I'm going to leave it right there.
You think that weighed in there, influenced how Paterno handled it, basically, is what you're saying?
You know, I think he reported it up. If we recall correctly.
To Gary Schultz.
Yeah, and Linda Kelly, in her, if I recall correctly, in the press conference, said that he reported it up, and that's why he didn't get charged. And in his mind, he did what he was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. But I can't get you to commit yes or no. He should have been fired.
I didn't vote. Nobody's going to believe that. I know that. But I didn't vote on it because that was the board's decision. I was on the board. I stopped going to meetings as this investigation got hot but that was their decision.
Yeah. And it's okay to keep that, your opinion, private still if you want to, but I'm not going to get you to say
you got
one
me
way.
As far as I'm
well, I
didn't think
shot.
I was going to go this far today.
So, Brad, there are a few things there in that that clip. I want to go back to the budget part. Mm-hmm. Basically, one of the big problems that Tom Corbett had as governor of Pennsylvania was communications. He said right off the bat there that they did not do a good job, they meaning the administration, did not do a good job of letting Pennsylvanians know what was coming, how bad the economic situation was, and that, oh, we had told, we've said to the education establishment not to use that money because it was going to go away. Or if you did use it, remember, it's not going to be made up for by the state automatically. The governor, and I heard this from Republican legislators as well, members of the governor's own same party, when they would come in off the record, they would say, we don't know what this administration's doing. You know, there are things that we agree on, but we can't find out from the governor's office what the governor wants to do. So there was a huge communications problem.
Yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. The communications issues, though, it's not like he wasn't saying these things when he was in office. He was, but somehow that message just wasn't resonating with the constituency or the administration's. Just had a difficult time getting it out to where they needed it to be heard. We talked about that education line item on Ask the Governor probably for an entire year after that budget came out. He was trying desperately to make the case that he didn't cut education funding. But in the end, it all came down to a semantic argument. As you pointed out, the line item was reduced. There's numbers are numbers, and numbers don't lie. It was just about whose fault was it.
Well, and it's unusual that voters have a memory that long. That was the first year of the administration. I mean, it wasn't just education. Higher education, money to state universities was cut back by a tremendous amount. But it's unusual for voters to remember those things. So those parts of the administration, what the governor had done— I remember him saying on this program that I told people when I was running these things were going to happen. But after he did them, they were not popular with the voters.
No, they weren't. And ironically, you bring up higher education. When I got to the point of the interview where I said, okay, what are your regrets? He listed higher education as one of them, saying we needed to do more for higher education. And this all comes, you know, under the cloud now of these studies that are looking at whether or not maybe we should merge or even close one of the 14 state-owned schools. But he said that higher education was going to be one of his big second-term goals. He just never got a chance to do that.
Well, quickly, because I do want to get on to something else, mm-hmm. but, you know, he talked a lot there about Penn State.
Yeah.
It may be hard for people to believe, especially from outside the state, that Sandusky, Paterno firing, Penn State sanctions, that had a big impact on the election.
It did, and I think the biggest thing that comes out of this for me is, and I felt this way when it happened, I just don't believe he, in his mind, is able to separate Jerry Sandusky and Joe Paterno the way it should be. He is correct in a post hoc ergo proctor hoc after it, therefore, because of it, that Paterno did follow Sandusky, but those are two very separate issues. The Paterno firing, although it came after Sandusky, was in itself a unique event, and it hurt him.
Kathleen Kane ran for Attorney General of Pennsylvania, and Penn State was a big issue there. She claimed that Tom Corbett, as Attorney General, slowed down the investigation for political reasons, because he was going to run for governor and didn't want voters to think about it. She promised an investigation. Investigation was conducted. It found that was not the case, that Corbett did not slow it down as Attorney General. You ask him about Kathleen Kane and her demise.
Well, you're out of office. What, if anything, do you have to say about her insinuations against you and her fall from grace?
Well, first off, and what I'm saying is totally opinion. That's a legal statement. She was totally unqualified for the position, clearly demonstrated by her own actions. And unfortunately, some of those actions were criminal in nature. And she had a huge, as you say, fall from grace. I was in a unique position. I really couldn't say things because of investigations that were going on that I was aware of. But, you know, she used that to win an election. She was successful winning an election, but she lost the office. Doesn't get any worse than that. Didn't help me. I know that, you know, from a standpoint, there are people that still believe that I'm responsible for everything that happened. I actually talked to a lawyer yesterday, 2 days ago, who still doesn't believe that Sandusky did anything wrong.
Really?
Yes. And I said, well, he's a friend of mine. And I just said, well, this is where we're going to disagree. Because I was convinced, but I was convinced that we needed more than one witness. And it was demonstrated that way. And we got somebody off the street. So total accomplishments that we were talking about before mm-hmm. as governor, well, that was a combined, not necessarily governor, it was more attorney general, that we got somebody off the street. Not an easy case to investigate or to prosecute, but it was something, it was my duty to do it. We did it. Linda Kelly completed it when I became governor. I think it's very unfortunate what she did to the office. There are some things that I believe.
Oh, bad edit there. That's my edit, by the way.
Yeah, that's not my edit.
Anyway, Brad, I get the sense that former Governor Corbett has a difficult time separating his time from Attorney General as that of governor.
I think he's very proud of his time in both of the offices, but he's a prosecutor. He treasured being attorney general.
Yeah, that language he used in the first one.
Calling the budget, the delivery.
We're almost out of time. Brad, I want to thank you very much for being with us and just providing a few of these clips from former Governor Tom Corbett. Where can listeners hear the entire interview?
We're releasing the special edition of Ask the Governor to our 50 affiliates across Pennsylvania today. If you can't catch it on one of the radio stations, you can catch not only the edition of Ask the Governor, but also the entire uncut interview on PAMatters.com.
Chris, WITF's Radio PA News Director, thank you very much. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we talk about women running for office in Pennsylvania.
Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to reducing hospital-acquired infections and readmission rates. More information on UPMC Pinnacle's achievements in patient safety can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/quality. Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless.